On this episode of Skeptico,
authentic religious myths can bring us beyond the constraints of this game. That's what they are pointing to. They're pointing at something beyond linear logic, beyond space and time, beyond the constraints that we willingly adopt in our ordinary relationship with reality. We shouldn't give those constraints up, but I think we shouldn't lose willingly our only umbilical connection to something that goes beyond that either.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, as you just heard, we welcome back Dr. Bernardo Kastrup, who is always a delight to talk to. He's so smart. He's so well-spoken on these important issues that we talk about. As you know, I have a lot of respect for him, but counter to how I sometimes get chided by some of you, I definitely don't take it easy on Bernardo in this interview. In fact, I push him pretty hard on a couple of points, and I hope you'll see where I'm coming from. Before we get to the interview, I wanted to let you know that Bernardo, who has an excellent website, excellent blog at metaphysicalspeculations.com, has just stirred up another controversy since the recording of this interview. And it's really, really interesting series of posts that he's done on the neurological effects of LSD. And if you're looking for a great example of how science can generate data and misunderstand the meaning of the data they're generating, well, then please check out those series of posts by Bernardo as well, and I'll have a link to those in the show notes. So that isn't really a proper introduction to this interview, but I did want to alert you to that, and I don't think this one needs that much of an introduction anyway. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Bernardo Kastrup. Today we welcome back to Skeptico one of your favorite guests and one of mine as well, philosopher, author, blogger, Dr. Bernardo Kastrup is here. He's got a new book, a fascinating new book called More Than Allegory on Religious Myth, Truth, and Belief. So, Dr. Bernardo Kastrup is warming up to religion. I bet you didn't expect to hear that, but we will hear it. We will hear it here on Skeptico. Bernardo, it's great having you back, and thanks so much for joining me.
It's great to be here again, Alex. Thanks for having me.
So this is quite a fascinating book, and as we were just chatting about a minute ago, and we've talked about it actually in another Skype conversation that we didn't record, there's so many points that intersect with the work that you've done for a long time and some of the work that I've done here on Skeptico. This is such an important and interesting topic. I know we're going to have a lot of fun with it, and I hope listeners enjoy this dialogue as much as I think that I will. So let's dive right into it. Tell us about this book and the basic premise behind it.
It's an exploration of religion and what value it may have for us individually and for society at large. And one of the key questions that I look into in the book is there any truth value to religion? Is there any way in which religion expresses truth at some level, in some form? Because if there isn't, then there is no point anyway. I think there is, and that's one of the things I launch to explore in the book.
Okay, so explore that further, because I think we can hear in there the implied assumption that religion isn't being taken seriously and needs to be, from a philosophical or an reason-based standpoint, be propped up a little bit. I mean, that's kind of what I'm hearing there. You do frame this up in terms of a culture war issue, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, religion has been with us since very early times in the evolution of our species. Since we began to think symbolically, religion has been with us thousands and thousands of years. To deny religion, at least as a very strong psychosocial phenomenon, is naive. And to say that this amazing phenomenon is purely delusion, I think that is a puerile, very easy way out. It glances over all the important issues here. And I think it's time that we reviewed it and looked more seriously into it and legitimized it in a way.
Okay, and I grant you that. Let me start by asking you this. Do you think that this culture war issue regarding religion is, I don't know, where it was 10 years ago? I mean, I push this sometimes and people push back, and I've started to hear maybe the truth in their pushback and saying, you know what, we've moved on. You know, Richard Dawkins isn't a hot topic anymore. Atheists seem more and more silly to more and more people. Do we need to move on? Have we moved on as a society, as a culture, a little bit past this, oh, religion is stupid kind of thing?
I think there are fashions, and maybe the fashion has changed, and maybe it's no longer fashion to bash religion like Richard Dawkins and others used to do, and still do, by the way. But maybe they are not taken anymore as seriously as they were taken before. But the question is, aside from the fashion, aside from the outspoken militant cultural dialogue, what about our personal relationship with religion? I think that has not been reviewed sufficiently. I think there is a much faster, much broader advancement of a kind of aloofness towards religion than the advancement of fundamentalism. I think people are becoming more and more disconnected from this primordial religious impulse that belongs in the human race. And I think that is much more worrying than whatever fashion, whatever cultural militant debate there might be or not be going on right now. It's about our inner lives at the end of the day. And what I see is that people are losing more and more their sense of meaning and transcendence. And these are the things we get from a healthy relationship with religious myths.
Boy, I keep hearing, though, a little bit of condescending tone. It's like, yes, let's examine it. Of course it's not real. Of course it's not true. Of course it's a psychosocial phenomena that comforts you at night. But. Who really is interested in that kind of re-examination of religion? Religious people aren't. Religious people are, I'm fine. This belief nurtures me in a way that's much deeper than what you're talking about. And non-religious people, other than just being nice, politically correct, socially kind, what interest do they have in a deeper re-examination of that?
I think you just touched on a key point. I think nobody should be interested in religion just because it comforts us at night. Because the moment you're interested in religion for that reason alone, it no longer comforts you because it isn't true anymore. It becomes a matter of convenience, a sort of a little tale we tell ourselves in order to reach a comfort level. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm putting forward is that authentic religious myths, legitimized by time and history, point to something that is true, not only comforting, but true, to truths about reality, about nature, about our condition in nature, that cannot be literally explained according to linear logic, in a linear, rational way. There is no reason to believe that the human intellect has evolved to grasp linearly all relevant truths about reality. Yet we have a part of our minds, which depth psychologists would call the unconscious mind, I prefer to call the obfuscated mind, which is not constrained by the linear constraints of the intellect. And history shows us that this part of our minds has been in contact with primordial truths about reality, ineffable truths that cannot be put in words, that cannot be made sense of according to linear logic, and which nonetheless are true and are essential aspects of nature. And I think that is the value of religion. It's a symbolic way of pointing at these actual truths, not only comforting fairy tales, but actual truths. They are not literal, they are not linear, but they are true. And our ability to relate to religious myths at an emotional, non-intellectual level, that's what we've been losing. We think that the intellect either can understand it or it isn't true. Hey, there is something, there's a lot out there that is true and cannot be made sense of intellectually. And by discarding that, we are losing our connection with transcendence and meaning.
Give us an example, because again, there is this contradiction that's kind of wrapped in there. It's true, it's true, it's true, I hear you saying. And then I hear you slipping in and saying, it's not literally true. I think a lot of people are going to have a hard time with that. And even I have a hard time with that. But before I pull it apart, I want you to give me a better example of where you think that can really come to a head, an example that people can really get their arms around.
I'll try to give you an example. Before I do that, let me just make a disclaimer. If I could translate religious symbolism fairly into a linear, literal narrative, then we wouldn't need religion anymore. We would just go for the linear, literal narrative, which is much more straightforward to communicate. So what I'm saying is precisely that what religious myths, the authentic ones, the history-proven ones...
Hold on, because we keep going past this. Give us an example of an authentic one, a history-proven one.
You just look at the myths that have been with us for thousands of years and whose elements are common to various religions. For instance, the Christian myth of the Trinity, you can see that in Hinduism. In the Christian Trinity, you have the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. In Hinduism, you have Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. You have that in Jewish Kabbalah. It's everywhere, the idea of the Trinity. You see that in some Aboriginal creation myths. So that's an example. That's a symbol. The Trinity is a symbol. It's pointing at something. If we could communicate that something in literal, linear, logical terms, we wouldn't need the religious symbolism. We could get rid of religion. So that's precisely what I'm saying. These myths are pointing at things that cannot be said in other ways. That's their value. That said, I can try to give you a quick example. Of course, I would destroy the symbolism the moment I translate it, but at least it gives people a taste, if you like.
Yeah. Let's stick with the Trinity. I'm not sure what is the underlying truth that really comes through to me. I don't understand that. I understand it inside of the myth as an allegory, but not as more than an allegory. Take me a little bit further there. Take that example, why there's an underlying deeper truth in that.
You're asking me to translate it into linear, direct, explicit, literal terms in order to make sense of it. We can sort of, as Jung called it, we can circumambulate it. We can go around it and show different perspectives of it to suggest the deeper meaning. But the deeper meaning can't be explained directly. Trinity, we can amplify that and talk about triangle, talk about a manifestation requiring two polarities in order to manifest. So the two polarities being two points and the manifestation being the third one. You can talk about, like in the Kabbalah, division of a unit into two different polarities. So these are ways to go around what this thing is pointing at. But if we restrict our understanding of the symbolism to these literal translations, we basically kill the myth. We wouldn't need it if that were enough. I can give you another example. There is a...
Let me throw an example on the table, because I think it might take us in a different direction. Consider the flood myth, right? The flood myth, the continuation of society by a brave few or a brave individual who... Right? So, but now take the flood myth and maybe consider, you know, Graham Hancock's latest book, which is a redo of his past book, and say, oh, maybe there isn't an allegorical connection to the flood myth. Maybe there's a real catastrophic environmental event connected to that flood myth. So can we really say that about religious myths? Can we really paint them with such a broad brush, and don't we need to really kind of tear them apart one by one and look at them?
Of course. When I talk about religious myths, I'm not talking about the entire corpus, the entire canon of a particular religion, which consists of many books, many stories, many tales. I'm completely open to the idea that the myth of the flood, which you see everywhere, is an echo of far distant historical events at the end of the last ice age. I'm completely open to that. Actually, I'll go further. I would say that I think that's the best explanation for the consistency with which we see this particular story reflected in the world's cultures. When I talk about religious myths, I'm talking about a symbolic core, an essence, which usually can be captured in a couple of pages. In Aboriginal creation myths, the entire myth can be summarized in a couple of pages, and it has many key symbolical elements. These are the things that are referred to. In the Christian myth, that would be the Trinity, that would be the idea of the incarnation of God in the world, the crucifixion, the symbol of the cross, and the resurrection.
Okay, so let's take that those Christian aspects to it. And then here's the part I guess I keep pushing against, you know. I'll give you an example. We just did a show on Skeptico about cults and near-death experience science. And we really focused on this one particular cult that seems to have made inroads into this one near-death experience research organization. And the funny thing about it is it really kind of sent me to looking at cults in general and the appeal of cults. And it really raises a lot of questions on a lot of different levels. Because as people have pointed out, and people pointed out in the Skeptical Forum, and it's undeniable as soon as you look into it, almost every religious tradition you can look at has a strong cult-ish element to it. I mean, the Christian cult, the Mormon cult, all these cults. But does that mean that in the extended consciousness realm, that is where I think the rubber meets the road here, when we get to extended consciousness, when we get to people seeing Christ consciousness when they have a near-death experience, and they want to know, is that real or is that not real? That's where I think people are connecting with their religious myths. And that becomes a really difficult thing to tear apart, because sometimes who and what they're connecting with in these extended consciousness realms don't line up with history. So we have kind of another tangled web here when we're trying to balance a historical timeline with what's happening with, I think, these transcendent experiences that most people are saying are at the core of these religious experiences. That was a terribly phrased question, but there's two parts of that. Let me try and pull apart. One is, how do we incorporate in the transcendent spiritual experience that you and I probably would at least agree has to be looked at in this extended consciousness realm, not from the realm that you and I are talking about, but there's some realm beyond that where these things seem to be happening. So that's part number one. And then part number two is, how do we tie that back to our history?
There's a lot to comment on there. I don't think that every religious myth originates from a particular individual, remarkable, transcendent experience of extended consciousness. I think religious myths tend also to percolate from the obfuscated mind up into our self-reflective awareness, in the same way that intuitions percolate up, in the same way that you dream at night and remain with a certain feeling, a certain impression of that throughout the day. When that happens at a large social scale, you may end up with a religious myth. I mean, we are constantly connected with the obfuscated mind in very subtle ways. So I don't think it's necessarily the case that one person has a mind-blowing trance-like experience to generate a religious myth. Now, even if that does happen, as in the case of near-death experiences, I think a mistake that most people tend to make is to project onto the realm, if we want to use that word, the realm of that transcendent experience, the NDE, the same characteristics of our current seemingly objective world. In other words, we tend to interpret what people experience there as literally true. So if somebody saw Jesus, then it must be Jesus. If somebody else saw the Buddha because he had a different cultural background, then there is a conflict, there is a contradiction. It's either Jesus or the Buddha. I submit to you that what people experience there are symbols of a deeper truth, which are translated into ways that they can make sense of symbolically according to their own background. So there is something there that everybody experiences, but each person experiences according to the clothing, to the masks of his or her own cultural background in the form of symbols. And last comment I'd like to make on what you just said. Everything human beings do can be turned into an ideology and then abused. Religion is no exception to that. Economics is no exception to that. Politics, social dogmas, and so on. Everything can be abused. And institutions can also abuse of everything. So in defending the value of primordial religious mythology, true religious mythology, I'm not necessarily defending cults, institutions, priests and other clergy who may find themselves using this primordial religious impulse for self-benefit, for power, for economic gain, or for whatever. I'm not defending any of that. I'm defending simply the idea that we should not generalize this primordial religious impulse with all the negative aspects of institutionalized religion. We shouldn't throw away the baby with the bathwater. Yes, there is much negative to be said about religion in the world today and historically as well, perhaps even much more than today if we go back in time. But that doesn't mean that there is no value to that primary sense, to that primary intuition of transcendence and meaning. We are crazy to throw that one away.
Okay, but I'm going to pull this back to the near-death experience science again, because there's some points that we can grab onto. There's some islands in the ocean of all these abstractions that we can kind of at least have the illusion of having real data we can grab onto. So the near-death experience, you're saying that the experience with Christ consciousness isn't really Christ consciousness. It's the percolating up of some deep-seated kind of meme or psychological common shared idea of what that is. Okay, let's put that over there as a possible hypothesis. Do you say the same thing about someone's connection with friends and family that is a common feature of a near-death experience, is that they meet people who have been deceased? We can even get really concrete with it and say they seem to only meet people who have been deceased. There have been many reports of people who meet people that they didn't even know were deceased and then later found out that they were deceased. So let me add one other part that's just a little bit beyond the near-death experience. But we have many, many other examples in after-death communication, much of which has been studied pretty scientifically for a long time, that suggests there's a reality to this extended consciousness realm that connects us with our dearly departed, deceased loved ones. So would we say the same thing about that? It's as part of the near-death experience and as a part of after-death communication in general, that, hey, that's not real. It's just a cultural interpretation. It's wish fulfillment. It's all the rest of that.
I didn't say it was not real.
No, I didn't say it. I just want your opinion. I didn't say that you did say it. I mean,
I think it is real, but it may not necessarily be real in a naive, literal, linear way. I'll share an opinion with you and your audience. I think a lot of the psychological motivation behind the interest in near-death experiences is the search for confirmation that our personal identity endures beyond physical death. That's an ego survival impulse. I am an idealist, a philosophical idealist, as you know. I think that reality is in a transpersonal form of consciousness, and that what we call individualized consciousness, or individual human beings and individual animals, are just split off, dissociated complexes of a universal consciousness, dissociated alters. There is no intrinsic reality to individuality. There is only one thing going on, one sense, one pure sense of I, which is the I of nature as a whole. So to me, it isn't important whether personalized, dissociated consciousness endures beyond physical death. It may. There seems to be very suggestive evidence that it does. But it doesn't really turn me on to go into the question of when people see diseased relatives and loved ones, are they symbols or are they still whirlpools of consciousness? Are they still dissociated alters of universal consciousness?
But isn't it much more than just whether it interests you or motivates you? It seems to be core to this, central to this question that we're talking about. Because if consciousness, individuated consciousness, survives in some way similar to what they're talking about, then we're really talking about a whole different.
Okay. So let's take a very well known case. Let's take Anita Morjanis, if I remember her name correctly.
Sure.
If you go through her report, which is I think one of the most cogent NDE reports I've read. And it seems to me to be a very honest report. She talks very openly about not only meeting a diseased relative, like I think it was her father, but becoming that diseased relative. So she talks about becoming her father. Now, what does it mean then to ask the question, is her father a symbol or is it really her father as a separate entity and there is something it is like to be her father? She just became her father. She just felt what it is to be her father. And is her father a symbol? Let me put it this way. It may be that the answer to the question is yes for both. It is a symbol. And it is a dissociated alter of universal consciousness, still dissociated after physical death, because people right now alive may be nothing but symbols as well. We are operating under this assumption that this world is not symbolic and that the afterlife, whatever it may be, is different. It is symbolic. Maybe this world is symbolic as well. Maybe we are living in a world of symbols and metaphors right now.
Right, but I think we got a problem if we say when we start trying to understand our world in the way that you're trying to understand it, which is necessary. We all want to play this consensus reality game. I see you, you see me, I touch my computer. That's a reality. We all want to play that game and pretend that that's real because it's the only way we can kind of make things make sense. So we play that consensus reality game, and then you say things like, these things aren't literally true. But then I play the same consensus reality game, and I look at after-death communication, and I say, no, by every means we have of measuring it, the best we can come up with is consciousness seems to survive bodily death in the way that it's been described throughout time, throughout cultures, and that's that your deceased grandfather really is there and really does see what you're doing. Now, whether he is a broken off sliver of an infinite number of other aspects of consciousness or not, I don't know, you don't know, I don't think we can come close to. But in terms of the experience that we have, again, look at the numbers. You know, 60% of people who have a longtime partner who is deceased has communication with that partner. Now, then you can pull that apart and go, oh, it's a delusional or whatever. So then go study it scientifically, study after-death communication, study it, you know, in every way that you can, and you know, spontaneous after-death communication, controlled after-death communication, you know, induced after-death communication. Mm. Every way you can do it, the same data comes back. They're there. Your ancestors are there. And that's why every culture has said that, because there's a certain reality to it. Again, if we're going to play the consensus reality game. So I'm just not willing to give up on that point, because I don't know how we can leave it behind to just fit into something else.
I think it is valid. You know me, I have been playing the consensus reality game for a while. I don't give up on that either. I think within the constraints of that consensus reality game, we can have a much better cultural narrative than silly physicalism. But I'm willing to play the consensus reality game as well. And what does it mean to play that game? It means to apply linear logic, rationality, the axioms of Aristotelian logic, if you will, empirical honesty to what we can verify empirically. That's what it means to play that game. And I think it's valid to play that even for studies of NDEs and whatever the afterlife may or may not be. My point, however, and that's the core of the thing, is that I think religious myths, authentic religious myths, can bring us beyond the constraints of this game. That's what they are pointing to. They are pointing at something beyond linear logic, beyond space and time, beyond the constraints that we willingly adopt in order in our ordinary relationship with reality. We shouldn't give those constraints up, but I think we shouldn't lose willingly our only umbilical connection to something that goes beyond that either. And that's what those myths are pointing to. And I think it would be a pity for us to start believing that the only game there is, that all reality can be captured in space and time thinking and linear logic. That would be a pity.
For you personally, how do you connect with that idea of the transcendence of religious myths?
For many years in my life, I lost contact with that. As a kid, I had basically a scientific, liberal education. I was exposed to religious liturgy from the side of my mother, but I lost contact with that. I went to university at 17, and I dismissed that even before that. And for many years, I lost it. Only in my mid-30s, it sort of a new sensitivity woke in me. A sensitivity to things beyond just the straight jacket of rationality, of linear thinking. And I recovered some of that. I had some intuitive experiences while I was visiting medieval cathedrals in Europe, which I was doing, at least that was my own narrative, because I was interested in the architecture.
So you were telling yourself at some level that at a logical, rational level, oh, I like the architecture, I like the music, I like the glass, the way the light comes in through the glass, and you're drawn to these places, and you feel that at a deeper level, maybe you were drawn there for another reason.
Yes. So that gave me some exposure, which was helpful. Another thing that happened is that in articulating my philosophy, my ontology in a very linear, very rational, empirically consistent way, I started realizing that it resonated a lot with the very old religious myths. And I describe them in the book. I do a review of creation myths and religious myths that basically are symbolic articulations of idealism, of this idea that all reality is in a transpersonal form of consciousness. And that also triggered me. I started thinking, hey, if this is the case, what else are these myths pointing to? It gave me a sense of, it allowed me to give some credibility to these myths. And then personal experiences happened that gave me a taste of what the myths are actually pointing to, these transcendent aspects of reality that these myths are pointing to, and which cannot be put in words in a way that does justice to them. It's something that you have to experience yourself. The myths enable that personal jump to a different cognitive space, to a transcendent cognitive space, by pointing and by fomenting a kind of openness to that possibility. And these are key conditions, I think, for anybody who hopes to have these experiences themselves.
Has that transcendence led you towards a concept of God? I think that is really the question that a lot of people have in their life. They boil it down to that kind of simple, is there God, is there not a God? And I've always wondered about that in your writing. You seem to kind of be very careful with talking about the hierarchical nature of consciousness. To me, it seems inevitable that when we start going down the lines that you're going down, we arrive at some concept that starts looking or starts sounding a lot like what a lot of people have a long time called God.
I'm much more open to that than I was when we talked for the first time on Skeptico a few years ago. I'm open to using the G word now. If you look at, if I can just give you a couple of examples, a basic Hindu myth is the idea that Brahman creates the framework of the world in the form of primordial waters, and then he creates a primordial egg in that world. And then Brahman himself is born, hatches from the primordial egg within the world of his creation. And if you look at the Christian myth, God is born within his own creation in the form of the Christ, through a human woman. So these things are pointing somewhere. There is an Aboriginal myth in which Karora, the creator deity, dreams the world up into existence and then wakes up within his own dream. So you have this theme again and again and again in so many different places of the idea that the world is a mental creation of a deity, which then enters his own creation by waking up in the dream or hatching from an egg that he puts within his creation, or by being born as Jesus the Christ. This is pointing not only at what the idea of the deity means, but it's also pointing in a very rich way to the relationship between us people and that deity.
You know, Bernardo, one of the things that I think people really like and connect with about your work is that you really do hold to a philosophical rigor in your analysis of some of these very hard topics. How do you reconcile that with what you've discovered in this transcendent experience of religious myths?
Okay. I think we can articulate a very rigorous, very logically consistent and empirically honest cultural narrative today, an ontology, if you will, to make sense of the nature of reality, one that is much superior to physicalism / materialism in terms of parsimony and in terms of explanatory power.
Okay, so this is the Bernardo we know that kind of bashes the materialist straight on and says, look, it just doesn't make sense logically. We can break it down. Materialism, physicalism has been falsified, and you do an extraordinary job of that. And actually, you just sent me a new paper on that I think is the clearest example yet, and I'll provide a link in the notes as well. So that's one part. We get that. So yes. Where do you go from there?
Okay. So, and that is sufficient to change the cultural narrative today. We should change our cultural narrative today because on the basis of logic, empirical honesty, and parsimony, and explanatory power, there is no reason to stick to the nonsense of physicalism. Now, the alternative cultural narrative, which we might call idealism or non-dual conscious realism, whatever name we give to it, that, in my view, is a subset of what is really, really going on. And it is a subset that we can grasp and package within, we can corral within the constraints of language, linear thinking, logic, rationality. It's a subset.
Explain that a little bit further. I think that's such a cool idea. But give us an example that really drives that home. Where is an example of that where maybe that thinking could be grounded for someone they'd understand? They could point to that person and go, oh, so you're saying that person thinks this.
My articulation of idealism entails the existence of space-time because I talk about whirlpools, dissociative processes. I talk about dynamics that unfold in time. I don't think space and time really exist. I think they are myths that we create ourselves because nobody has ever experienced time. We only experience one thing called the now. in the past and the future, stories we tell ourselves in the now. Now, that is something that you cannot put in language, because language already entails the existence of space-time in the different tenses in which we conjugate verbs, for instance. Language already entails the separation between subject and object. It's built into language. And language also has the constraints of logic built into it in the form of a grammar.
So, and would you say the same thing about non-dual thinking, in the same way, is constrained in a way that it tries to kind of get outside of itself, but it can't because it's in the same soup?
Well, it can't, to the extent that you want to communicate it. When we talk about a cultural narrative, we are talking about something that needs to be communicated in language, because that's the way we can share things in a straightforward way. And the moment you need to communicate, you're already talking about a subset. We can have a much better subset than the delusions we are living under today, but that new, better subset is still not the whole game, because there is a lot about this game that we cannot put in language and cannot communicate. We have to experience it ourselves. And that's where I think religious myths come in. They bring us beyond the best cultural narrative which we could come up today by pointing at something, creating the conditions for a personal experience of something beyond space-time and linear logic. And that's where we can find meaning and transcendence.
And that's where we can find meaning and transcendence. Great point. I love the idea, and I love the concept behind it. Where do you see yourself going with this book immediately? Where is it already leading you in terms of future jumping off points for your work?
That's difficult to say. Right now, I finished this book last year, several months ago. It's been in production for a while. I think going forward, I will focus more again on establishing a rock-solid, robust intellectual alternative to physicalism. I've been working with some professional philosophers now and going more in that direction, maybe even cozying up more to academia than I was before. This book...
Doesn't that stand a little bit in contrast with the transcendent... Yes.
It does. I'm looking for balance in my own mind, and my work reflects my search for balance. So I'm oscillating between two things, because I think it's very important that we don't throw the baby of transcendence and meaning together with the bathwater. And at the same time, I think we should really, really reform our cultural narrative, because the one we have now is a complete disaster. Not only because it's depressive, there are more depressive things, because it's just wrong and provably so. It's just a bad cultural narrative. So I'm oscillating between these two things. It's possible that my personal development, independent of my work, well, it's not only possible, that's what's happening, Alex. Let me be very clear with you. At the same time that I'm working on a rock-solid, robust intellectual articulation of a different cultural narrative, at the same time, my own personal life, my own emotional life is bringing me to very serious crossroads, to a point, and I even posted it on Facebook the other day, and I think a lot of people found it cryptic, a point where I think it's either a breakdown or a breakthrough, if you know what I mean.
I can relate to you in what you're saying, and I feel kind of the same way, and I haven't said any of this about Skeptico. But I feel kind of the same way. And I come back and I keep seeing value in pursuing this path of logic and reason. But I've been trying to connect with more and more of a devotional side and a spiritual side of me. And one way I've done that is through music and through kirtan. And there's this one singer I really like, Krishna Das. And I have a special spiritual connection with his deceased master named Karoli Baba, for whatever that means. And he has this beautiful song, and he was pressed to say, you know, where did you come up with that song? And he says, well, there's this ancient Indian myth of this man who is devotional and is singing and is praising Krishna, and he comes across an old man who is sitting there and he's teaching Sanskrit to children. And he's very intent on it. He's very logic-based and he's very learned and he's highly respected because he knows this ancient language. And he says, hey, old man, you've figured it out now. You know enough. Get up. Come on. Devote yourself. Devote yourself to God. Devote yourself to this greater consciousness. And I think about that lately. And I think about, I don't want to be that old man. I don't want to be that old man on my knees teaching Sanskrit when I know it's not really about the Sanskrit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's ultimately, it's not about any narrative. Ultimately, it's about a realization. Ultimately, it's not about explaining anything. Arriving at an explanation is arriving at a narrative. And the thing we are talking about here isn't a narrative. It's something that you experience. It's a form of being. At the same time, and to link that back to the fight on the cultural narrative, because otherwise we might conclude, why fight a cultural battle? Forget the cultural narrative. It's all about your own experience anyway. I think the cultural narrative can be either conducive or disruptive to the direct personal experience. And the one we have right now is extraordinarily disruptive to the point that it renders it nearly impossible for anyone educated under this cultural narrative to have the openness that is a precondition for the experience, a precondition for that form of being. So I think there's tremendous value in fighting the good fight and changing the cultural narrative, but it isn't the ultimate goal. It's just a precondition. And my personal life, because you see, I no longer, at least I have something positive to say about myself. I'm a neurotic mess, but at least I no longer suffer from the limitations of the cultural narrative, because in my mind, it's a done deal. I mean, this is ridiculous, and I'm fighting a cultural battle, but I'm not trying to convince myself anymore. In my mind, it's a done deal. And I think my personal emotional development now going forward, it's not something that is under the control of the ego. It's not something you choose to be like this or that. It just happens to you. Life leaves itself through you. You are being leaved by something, by a power beyond your ego. And that is bringing me in a direction that is beyond every narrative. And I don't know whether that will be ever reflected in my work. In parallel, I'm doing work. There will be a book after this one for sure. There will be many things after this book. But whether the core of my personal experience right now is ever going to make it to written word, I don't know. It's possible that it will never be the case.
Well, I doubt that, because I think you've already done a beautiful job just right there and in this book, more than allegory, of not just talking the talk, but really walking the walk about what it means to look beyond and to consider the larger and the greater, which is, I think, what this book is all about. And yet staying anchored with what we know to be true as well about our consensus reality. So I think it's just terrific. I'm always super inspired by talking to you, Bernardo, in the brave way that you tackle these topics. This book is sure to be one that you're going to want to pick up, More Than Allegory. It should be out right about the time when you're listening to this show. So check it out, More Than Allegory on Religious Myth, Truth, and Belief. Dr. Bernardo Kastrup, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Alex. It was a pleasure again.
No, and I say, and you said a really, really good and important point, and I hope this gets emphasized in the show too, in that, you know, kind of consolidating our victories is good too. You know, and for you to say, you know what, the falsification of materialism, that we can own. And say, you know what, that has propelled me forward. That has allowed me to kind of take a step through the fog and kind of clear a path. Yeah. And I don't know where that path leads, but it is a step, and it sure as shit feels like
absolutely
the right direction. Right.
It opens the gates. It opens the doors. It opens so many possibilities that we assume are not there. And I think that is the critical thing about getting rid of materialism and having a cultural narrative that we can defend very robustly, empirically, logically, that keeps those doors open. For me personally, my own journey, Alex, I could only make the steps I've made after this self-created barrier this notion that physicalism is the only game in town, after I took down that barrier for me personally, only then I could go forward. And whole universes opened up after that. Not narrative universes only, but real concrete experiential universes. And that has been critical. And I think we own it to the culture, to our culture, to fight this and consolidate this gang, and as you put it. And the rest is the unfolding of nature. The rest will happen by itself, because it isn't a narrative that puts a brake on us. It's putting a brake on nature. If you remove that with a better narrative, the rest unfolds by itself. It's the flow of nature. You can't stop it. It isn't pleasant. It can be very hard. For me, it's horrible sometimes. There are days I think, shit, I would prefer to go back in time and be in the illusion. Yeah. But it's a natural unfolding. It happens by itself if you're open to it.
Awesome. Thanks again to Bernardo Castro for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess I'd have one question to tee up from this interview. And it's one that I've asked before, but Bernardo has cast new light on it, and that is, are the religious traditions that are so much a part of our culture worth saving, preserving, nurturing? Is there, as Bernardo suggests, something more in those traditions, something inherently mystical and something important for us individually and for our culture to advance? What do you think? You probably know my opinion from listening to the show, but I'd like to hear your thought. And the place to do it, of course, is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com, where you can leave a comment or jump over to the forum and join in the conversation over there. Or, of course, you can always send me an email or connect with me on Facebook. While you're at the website, be sure to share a couple of posts that you like. Share them on Facebook. Share them with your friends through email, any way you can. That is, after all, the best way and really the only way we have of telling people about Skeptico and getting the word out. So please do that if you are inclined. Oh, let me mention that there is a video version of this interview. Bernardo and I put it together while we're doing it, and then he was nice enough to help me edit it. It's something I may try and get into in the future, so check it out. There'll be a link to it in the show notes. And if you do like it and you are interested in seeing more video, let me know that too. We'll see what we can do in the future. I do have a number of interesting shows coming up, some encounters with mainstream science types, and some folks who dare to walk outside of the chalk lines, if you will. So I certainly do hope you stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.